In the happy ending, Enoch rides into the sky on a fiery chariot. The Slavic Book of Enoch features additional passages which are missing from the Abyssinian version. The Slavic Book reports how Enoch was contacted by the heavenly beings. The books of the holy parables of Enoch, the wise man and great writer, whom the Lord took in and loved, so that he may see the dwellings of the highest. In the first month of the 365th year, on the first day of the first month, I, Enoch, was in my house alone, and two very tall men appeared before me, as I had never seen on earth. And their faces were shining like the sun, their eyes burning like torches, and fire was spewing from their mouths, their feathers of different looks, their feet purple, their wings more radiant than God, their arms whiter than snow. And they stood at the head of the bed and called me by my name. I awoke from my sleep and clearly saw those men standing next to me. And those men spoke to me, "Be brave, Enoch. You are going up to heaven with us today. And tell your sons and all the children of your house everything, how much they shall do in your house on earth without you. No one shall look for you until the Lord returns you to them." Enoch is lifted from the earth. There he is introduced to a number of angels. He is handed a device for speed writing and told to write down all that the angels dictate to him. "O Enoch, see the writing on the heavenly tablets, read what they say, and remember it all in detail." 360 books are created in this way. They are the God's testament to mankind. After many weeks, the strangers return Enoch to his house, but only so that he can bid farewell to his loved ones for good. He bequeaths the books which he wrote to his son Methuselah and gives him unmistakable orders to keep the book safe and to leave them for future generations of this world. What has happened to the books? All of them have vanished, except for the Enoch books mentioned above, and are presumed lost. Whenever the topic of Enoch comes up in discussions, and I suggest that the antediluvian prophet had the privilege to receive instruction inside an extraterrestrial spaceship, I am told that he would have needed some kind of spacesuit. Would he really have? Astronauts move freely without spacesuits inside our shuttles and space stations. Only the danger of unwanted contamination with viruses and bacteria would have forced the extraterrestrials and Enoch to protect themselves. What does Enoch, the attentive student, report? "And the Lord said to Michael, 'Approach and disrobe Enoch of his earthly garments, and anoint him with a good ointment, and clothe him in the robes of my splendor.' And Michael did as the Lord had told him. He anointed me and clothed me. And the appearance of the ointment was more than a great light, and its greasiness like good dew, and its aroma like myrrh, and shining like the rays of the sun. And I looked at myself, and I was like one of his splendid ones, and there was no difference in appearance." A curious description indeed. Should the one true and universal God supposedly give orders to have Enoch anointed with a particularly greasy, intensely aromatic ointment? Human beings have always had a very peculiar smell. Are there connections between the Old Testament prophet Enoch and the unknown King Sarid, who the Arabs credit with the building of the pyramids? A. Both lived prior to the Great Flood. B. Both were warned of the coming flood by gods. C. Both authored books about all the sciences. D. God personally instructed both of them in astronomy. E. Both gave orders that their works be preserved for future generations. In contrast to these parallels, there are also some serious discrepancies. Sarid is said to be buried in a pyramid. Enoch left the earth in a heavenly vehicle. And no indication is found in the existing books of Enoch that the biblical patriarch commissioned the construction of pyramids. Undoubtedly, we can also find parallels between Enoch, Sarid, and Hermes, the Greek messenger of the gods. But Hermes is not antediluvian, and neither did he build any pyramids. Professional experience has taught me to see more behind traditional folktales than just human imagination and creative storytelling. Myths can be screened in such a way that the ornamental additions are diluted and the fundamental truths enhanced. Around 700 BC, Hesiod, a Greek poet, wrote in his Myth of the Five Human Races that in the beginning the immortal gods, Cronus and his colleagues, created man. The exalted race of those heroes, called demigods, who lived on the infinite earth in a time before us. Demigods are also demi-humans, earthly beings with extraterrestrial genes. Hermes, Enoch, Idris, and Sarid, all of them were members of this elite group. For all of them, the designation "a very long time ago" is appropriate. Sources link all of them with written books that were hidden. This common denominator applies to Sarid, Idris, and Enoch, as well as to many other teachers of the human race, including the demigods described by Hesiod. If myths were really as nebulous as they are often made out to be, they would not yield any useful information. It has always been more convenient to accept someone else's teachings, proven or not, than to use one's own head and to take the time to find similarities in mythical contents. I am not talking about an academic comparison of myths here. That would require a much more extensive approach. I am still pondering the construction of the Great Pyramid and the possibility that ancient documents may lie inside the pyramid, which could revolutionize our entire religious thinking, as well as our notions about early human history and evolution. My friends, the Egyptologists, see no reason to discount Pharaoh Khufu as the builder of the Great Pyramid. The chronology of dynasties leaves no room for an additional ruler and possible builder after Khufu. They all erected their own precisely dated sacred monuments. Moreover, the names of the Egyptian kings are recorded on the Torino Papyrus, a document dated to the 13th century BC, which today is stored in Torino. Egyptologists also found the names of kings listed in the temple of Seti I in Abydos, as well as on several walls of the temple complex of Karnak. I do not begrudge Egyptologists their scrupulously documented, detailed lists. They have nailed down all the Egyptian rulers. Documented millennia. How does it look prior to Khufu? The recorded dynasties begin around 2920 BC with a so-called Tainit king named Menes. Min and Hor-Aha are also mentioned. Under Menes, however, the Egyptian state must have been rather well organized already, because Menes led military excursions past the borders of his empire. He also ordered the course of the Nile to be altered south of Memphis. Such tasks cannot be accomplished out of the blue. Menes must have had predecessors. The problem with dates is this. Christians count the years since the birth of Jesus Christ. The Romans counted the years after the founding of the city of Rome in 753 BC. With ancient Egypt, however, we have no fixed calendar starting point that can be translated into numbers. We are floating on pudding. There is nothing solid we can sink our teeth into. The experts went through great pains to reconstruct their chronology after Menes from datable findings, buildings, and astronomic calculations. Their dates are rather accurate, with a few exceptions. but they tell us nothing about the time prior to the First Dynasty. This is where legend enters the picture. To the amazement of scholars, the legends also list precisely the names and reigns of various kings and support them with numbers. But archaeology lacks the corresponding monuments or artifacts. How should we interpret names and dates that reach back thousands of years into the past, but are not documented with physical evidence? They are relegated to the realm of myths. It is believed that the Egyptian priest Manetho wrote 8 books, including one book about the history of Egypt. They list the names and dates of prehistoric kings, even back to the times of gods and demigods. Where did Manetho, who lived in the 3rd century BC, get his information? It was customary even back then to record time on the basis of extraordinary events. What ensued were lists of dates which grew into annals. The priests guarded and copied these annals so that they could recite the heroic deeds of certain individuals and the superb, admirable accomplishments of the gods. Even later on, in the heyday of the Pharaonic Empire, when the annals no longer recorded exact calendar dates, it was customary to consult the annals if extraordinary occurrences took place. The Egyptians wanted to check if similar events had happened at some time in the past. Allegedly, Ramses IV found his name written in golden letters on a tree when he visited Heliopolis. Immediately, the annals were consulted and checked all the way back to the beginning of the Pharaonic reign, as far back as history was recorded, but no mention was made anywhere of a similar event. Similarly, the annals were searched for evidence of unusual climatic disasters or the expected return of the gods. Manetho, the priest, was able to study such annals in researching his books. He writes that Hephaestus was the first ruler of Egypt, and that he invented, or brought, fire. He was followed by Cronus, Osiris, Typhon, one of Osiris's brothers, and then Horns, the son of Osiris and Isis. Eusebius states that after the gods, their offspring ruled the earth for 1,255 years, that then other kings reigned for 1,817 years, followed by 30 kings from Memphis, who dominated for 1,790 years, and finally by 10 Tinite kings, who ruled for 350 years. The rule of the spirits and divine offspring spanned 5,813 years. Eusebius, the bishop of Caesarea, who adopted these numbers from Manetho, emphasizes that these are lunar years, but they would still date back more than 30,000 solar years B.C. Not surprisingly, Manetho's numbers are challenged by scholars because there is no fixed reference point on which to base the dating process. When time frames encompass tens of thousands of years, archaeologists get uncomfortable. Manetho's figures are cut down to lunar years. He is accused of exaggerating because it would have been in his interest as a priest to enhance the credibility of the priesthood by giving it an ancient history. Those critics who do not doubt Manetho's integrity suggest that he copied old annals which were already full of exaggerations. It is difficult to understand, however, why other ancient writers, who were neither priests nor Egyptians, and who had nothing to gain by exaggerating the numbers, quote the same impossible dates. Diodorus Siculus, the historian who created a 40-volume historical chronicle and who is often skeptical, reports in his first book that the ancient gods founded many cities in Egypt. He also claims that some of the gods' offspring became kings of Egypt. In those ancient times, the predecessor of Homo sapiens was a primitive creature. Diodorus asserts that only the gods put an end to man's cannibalistic habits. The gods, according to Diodorus, taught man about the arts, mining, the manufacture of tools, agriculture, and the making of wine. The helpful divine beings also gave language and writing to mankind. For his god, Hermes, aka Enoch, was the first to bring language to perfection. He named many nameless things, invented the alphabet, and ordained ceremonies governing divine worship and sacrifices to the gods. He was the first to perceive order in the stars and to discern the nature and harmony of musical sounds. In short, they hold him to have been the sacred scribe of Osiris. It is plain as day. Unbeknownst to Diodorus, Enoch too is described as a sacred scribe. Just as Diodorus, who has never heard of the biblical patriarch Enoch, relates in his first-person narrative that the guardians of heaven taught many things, good and bad, to the people on earth. The name of the first is Jekun. He is the one who seduced all the children of the angels, brought them down to earth, and seduced them with the daughters of men. The second is named Asbel. He gave bad advice to the children of the angels, that they contaminated their bodies with the daughters of men. The third is named Gadriel. He is the man who taught the humans all kinds of deadly moves. He also seduced Eve, and showed the mortals murderous instruments, armor, shields, battle swords, and generally all kinds of murderous weapons. The fourth is Pene Muhe. He taught the humans the difference between bitter and sweet, and showed them all the secrets of their wisdom. He taught men how to write on paper with ink. Why do we discount such stories, which thousands of years ago were an integral part of historical knowledge? Do our historical interpretations, as far as they delve into the times before Pharaoh Menes, offer more reasonable facts? Are there any convincing arguments against Diodorus? I have been told that I am being too simplistic, that we cannot rely on Diodorus alone. True. But that is the curse of our specialized sciences. An Egyptologist knows nothing about ancient Indian sources. A Sanskrit scholar is unaware of Enoch or Ezra. An Americanist is as ignorant about Rig Veda as a Sumerologist is about the Mayan god Kukulkan, etc. And if some smart scientist actually does engage in comparative studies, it is always from a narrow-minded theological or psychological point of view. The evidence submitted by Diodorus was confirmed thousands of years ago internationally, even if the various authors used different names and details in their stories. In essence, all ancient chroniclers from all parts of the world present the same story. I wonder why we refuse to believe these people. I know that truth never triumphs, but its opponents gradually become extinct. Diodorus stated very matter-of-factly that the Egyptian god Osiris also founded a number of cities in India. The truth of this statement is so obvious to me that I have no patience for any academic discussion about it. What are the dates reported by Diodorus? They record that 10,000 years elapsed from the time of Isis and Osiris until the reign of Alexander, who founded the city in Egypt named after himself, and some write that it was just short of 23,000 years. A few pages later, Diodorus describes the battle between the Olympian gods and the giants. Diodorus maintains that the Greeks must be mistaken in placing the birth of Hercules a mere generation before the Trojan War, asserting that it was rather, the Egyptians argue, nearer the first origin of mankind, for from that the Egyptians reckon more than 10,000 years, but from the Trojan War, less than 1,200. Diodorus knows what he's talking about, because later he relates the Egyptian dates to his own visit of Egypt. He writes that the first rulers in Egypt for nearly 18,000 years were gods and heroes, and that the last of the gods to hold sway was Horus, son of Isis. But they say the country has been ruled by mortals now for close to 5,000 years, down to 118th Olympiad, at the time of my visit to Egypt. Diodorus did his homework. He studied the ancient sources that were available and talked to knowledgeable people. We did not. We destroyed the old libraries in the name of whatever religion was prevalent at the time. We burned precious old documents and murdered the learned and wise men of their cultures. The Library of Carthage contained 500,000 documents. Where are they? Burned. The Sibylline books and the Avesta of the Parsis, written in golden letters, where are they? Burned. The libraries of Pergamum, Jerusalem, Alexandria, with millions of documents, where are they? Burned. The priceless manuscripts of the Central American cultures, where are they? Burned. Our pyromaniacal past shines much more brightly than the dim wits of some of our revolutionary thinkers. Herodotus and the 341 statues. Herodotus, who visited Egypt several centuries before Diodorus, also illustrates the lengthy time frame of Egyptian history in the second book of his history. He recalls how the priests in Thebes personally showed him 341 statues, each of which was representative of one generation of high priests for the past 11,340 years. The custom being for every high priest during his lifetime to set up his statue in the temple. As the priest showed me the figures and reckoned them up, they assured me that each was the son of the one preceding him, and this they repeated throughout the whole line, beginning with the representation of the priest last deceased and continuing till they had completed the series. Why would the priests have lied so shamelessly to Herodotus about the 11,340 counted years? Why do they emphasize that no gods had been among them for 341 generations? Why did they use statues to illustrate their precise times and dates? Herodotus, who is far from being gullible, assures us that the priests proved to him that they were telling the truth. He carefully separates fact from fiction. Thus far, I have spoken of Egypt from my own observation, relating what I myself saw, the ideas that I formed, and the results of my own researches. What follow rests on the accounts given me by the Egyptians, which I shall now repeat, adding thereto some particulars which fell under my own notice. According to our academic doctrines, Menes was the first pharaoh of the first dynasty, around 2920 BC. Herodotus's report that Menes changed the course of the Nile above Memphis is widely accepted, while another fact, related by Herodotus only 18 lines later, is just as widely ignored. Next, they read me from a papyrus the names of 330 monarchs, who, they say, were Menes' successors upon the throne. Is there really no room for a monarch who could have built the pyramids among the 335 kings succeeding Menes? Moreover, in light of the statues which the priest displayed before Herodotus, each of which represented one generation of high priests, the question of lunar years becomes academic. You may deceive all the people part of the time, and part of the people all the time, but not all the people all the time. Abraham Lincoln. The Eyes of the Sphinx. Once upon a time, there was an Egyptian prince who liked to hunt near Memphis, where the great pyramids are. One day he sat down, exhausted, in the shade of the Sphinx, and fell asleep. Suddenly, the great god opened his mouth and spoke to the sleeping prince, as a father speaks to his son. Look at me, my son Thutmose. I am your father, the god Re Herakaiti Atum. I will give to you the kingdom. The treasures of Egypt and the great tributes of all nations shall be yours. For many years my eyes have been upon you, and my heart. The sand of the desert on which I stand is encroaching upon me. Promise me that you will fulfill my wish. The prince became Pharaoh Thutmose IV, 1401 to 1391 BC. In his first year as king, he addressed his divine father's plea. He had the Sphinx dug out from under the sand. Thutmose inscribed the touching story of his dream on a stele, which is located between the Sphinx's front paws. The Sphinx, is it male or female? No one knows for sure, because the experts cannot agree whether the colossal statue originally bore male or female traits. Maybe it had both. In any case, Thutmose did not save the Sphinx for long. Again, it was swallowed by the sand. Then the Ptolemies dug it up again, and the sand sucked it down again. Historically well documented is the excavation of 1818 at the hands of Giovanni Battista Caviglio, the same man who was chased off by Howard Wisey. Caviglio discovered an anteroom with a stone floor between the lion paws, which was divided up by a passageway in which a stone lion was found. 70 years later, the Sphinx had to be dug up again, this time by Gaston Maspero, then director of the Egyptian Department of Antiquities. 40 years later, the Sphinx disappeared under the sand once more. In the time of Herodotus, this strange and mysterious statue must have been invisible, because the father of history makes no mention of it. What is the Sphinx? A lion's torso, 57 meters long and 20 meters high, made from one gigantic boulder, with an enigmatic head and a veil over the back of its head. Kurt Lang, an Egyptologist, calls the statue the monumental symbol of royal power. What is it supposed to represent? What does it symbolize? What is its purpose? What was it intended for? There is no answer to these questions. The centuries have eaten away at the monument, possible inscriptions, and a statue which the Sphinx was cradling at one time have disappeared. Richard Lepsius wondered about the meaning of the Sphinx, which during his visit was half buried in sand. Which king does it represent? Lepsius asked, while wondering too, if the statue depicts King Khafre, why does it not carry his name? The eyes of the Sphinx are wide open. Expectantly, yet calmly, it surveys the tiny people below, deliberately, confidently, and even a little mockingly, it seems to me, head and shoulders above the world. The experts agree on one thing. The Sphinx of Giza is the oldest Sphinx, the mother, the model on which all later imitations were based. It is attributed to Pharaoh Khafre, not because of any solid evidence pointing in that direction, but merely because the name Khafre was found on a crumbled piece of the Thutmose stele, provided one wants to see the name Khafre on it. Thutmose lived more than 1,000 years after Khafre. He is the only one who could tell us in what context the name Khafre appeared on his inscription. Gaius Plinius Secundus writes, "Over against the said pyramids there is a monstrous rock called Sphinx, much more admirable than the pyramids. Within it the opinion groweth that the body of King Amasis was entombed, and they would bear us in hand that the rock was brought thither, all and whole as it is." Plinius also claims that, despite its marvelous statue, the Sphinx was largely ignored by ancient writers, and that it was from a single natural stone. The red face of the monster was worshipped like a god. Egyptologists do not list a king named Amasis in their records, and no tomb has been found under the Sphinx so far. Maybe Plinius's Amasis is identical to an Amasis mentioned by Herodotus. That would bring us right back to the realm of myth, because Herodotus writes that according to the Egyptians, 17,000 years had elapsed until the reign of Amasis. The Sphinx and the pyramids have been inextricably related throughout history. Both are monumental in size and nameless. No one would have been able to chisel a hybrid monster 57 meters long and 20 meters high out of rock in the wink of an eye. The fabulous statue could not have been created without detailed plans and blueprints or without scaffolding. On the pyramids, or inside, we would inspect inscriptions such as, "I, Pharaoh XY, created this building." On the Sphinx, an appropriate inscription would be something like, "I, Goddess, God, XY, am guarding this burial site." Or, "For eternity, I want to remind mankind of..." Why did neither the pyramids nor the Sphinx receive a label? Did some bombshell surround these buildings that, even back then, was deliberately obscured? Is the fact that these monuments are nameless more than just carelessness or malice on the part of later generations? Was it intended that way? Diodorus Siculus drops a bomb on us when he claims that some of the original gods were buried on Earth. I beg your pardon? And where, if I may ask? Diodorus reports that the information which was circulated regarding the burial of these gods was contradictory because the priests were prohibited from speaking their knowledge of these matters. They did not want the people to know the truth. Anyone who promulgated the secret knowledge about these gods among the masses faced great danger. Brief as it is, this passage has explosive implications. Gods are buried somewhere on this earth. The high priests were aware of this, but were not allowed to spread the news. Couldn't it be that one of the god kings was laid to rest under the Great Pyramid? Wouldn't it be irrelevant in that case if his name was Sarid, Idris, Hermes, Enoch, or anything else? If the Great Pyramid was built by a god king or the offspring of a god, if this happened before Khufu's time, if the Great Pyramid holds secret books and important devices, if one of these god kings is indeed buried inside the pyramid, then the namelessness is intentional. Diodorus solved the mystery. Disseminating the news about the tombs of the gods was strictly forbidden. And the Sphinx? In this scenario, the Sphinx becomes a grand memorial to the relationship between the terrestrial and the extraterrestrial element, between the earthly creature and the divine intellect. It is the petrified symbol of the union between flesh and analytical thinking, between raw primitive strength and sublime culture. For thousands of years, the Sphinx has been smiling sarcastically and sensitively. The eyes of the Sphinx are watching our progress benevolently until the day when our own eyes are opened. This day cannot be far off. The hidden chambers and tunnels inside the Great Pyramid have been located. A pharaoh disappears. There is yet another highly captivating mystery in store for us, this one set up by a pharaoh who, irrefutably, lived 60 years before Khufu, the third dynasty ruler, Sekhemket, 2611 to 2603 BC. This monarch had a pyramid of his own constructed southwest of the Step Pyramid of Saqqara, but apparently the pyramid was never completed. As a matter of fact, it only climbed to a height of about 8 meters. Over thousands of years, this pyramid disappeared completely below the desert sand. It was not until 1951 that it was resurrected by the Egyptian archaeologist Zakaria Gonim. Dr. Zakaria Gonim was considered a highly intelligent and talented archaeologist, the very opposite of a reclusive or stubborn scholar. His seminars and excavations were saturated with friendly humor. He always had a sensitive and open mind for the questions submitted by his students. It was one of his great talents to enliven the bare bones and ruins he excavated with interesting stories. When Zakaria Gonim discovered the entrance to a corridor under the pyramid of Sekhemket, he hoped and prayed that the sepulchre had survived the centuries intact. It took much sweat and many years to dig through the sand and rock formations. Zakaria Gonim located another corridor filled with thousands of animal bones, some of them from gazelles and sheep. He also found 62 broken tablets with text fragments from the year 600 BC. Someone had deposited them under the pyramid 2,000 years after the death of Pharaoh Sekhemket. Finally, in the last days of February 1954, the excavating team reached the entrance to the actual tomb, buried far beneath the desert. Zakaria Gonim generously stepped aside to let the Minister of Culture open the sepulchre officially. It was March 9, 1954, when the final decisive blow struck the entrance gate. Through one last tunnel, the men crawled to an underground hall, hewn roughly out of the rock, just like the unfinished burial vault under the Great Pyramid. In the center of the room stood a marvelous polished sarcophagus made from white alabaster, a kind of marble. The remains of a flower bouquet were scattered on the north end of the sarcophagus, a last farewell to the deceased pharaoh. Zakaria Gonim, realizing at once the significance of this find, immediately ordered his assistants to cover the plant dust carefully. The substantial amount of plant dust was proof that the sarcophagus had not been touched. The archaeologists and workers cheered, danced, and jumped with joy in the subterranean hall. Finally, an untouched sarcophagus. In the days that followed, the splendid sarcophagus was examined carefully. There was not a smidgen of evidence that it had been forced open within the past 4,500 years. There was no indication that anyone had even attempted to open it. Undoubtedly, Pharaoh Sekhemket was laid to rest inside the sarcophagus. The crumbled flowers cemented the archaeologist's faith. The magnificent sarcophagus, which looked as if it was made out of one piece of alabaster, was not only extraordinary because of its material and its creamy white color, but also because it featured a sliding door, which allowed it to be sealed off hermetically. Ordinarily, sarcophaguses are covered with a lid, which is placed on top of the sarcophagus casket. Not in this case. The sarcophagus of Sekhemket was equipped with a sliding door, much as an animal cage is, which could be raised from the front. Smooth tracks had been miraculously carved out of the alabaster. It was a unique and incomparable work of art, the most beautiful and also the oldest sarcophagus Egyptologists had ever laid eyes upon. Zakaria Gonim hired a special Sudanese police force to guard the vault day and night. Sudanese policemen were known for their stubborn adherence to orders. No one was allowed to enter. Nothing inside the tomb was to be touched until the official opening of the sarcophagus. The day finally came. It was July 26, 1954. Representatives of the Egyptian government, a select group of archaeologists, and dozens of journalists from all over the world had been invited. Film and photo cameras had been set up. Spotlights were trained on the sarcophagus. Chemicals were on hand in case something needed to be preserved right away. Overcome with intense feelings of hope and happiness, Zakaria Gonim took a last good look at the sarcophagus. Then he gave the order to open the alabaster coffin. Two workers wedged their knives and chisels into the barely visible cracks on the bottom of the sliding door. Ropes were tied to the door, and some other workers, positioned on top of the sarcophagus, pulled with every muscle they could muster. For 2 hours, everyone labored, trying to hoist the sliding door. Finally, it opened, just a crack. The alabaster was moaning and groaning as the door was lifted a few centimeters. Wooden wedges were placed under the door. Quietly, in breathless anticipation, the journalists and archaeologists watched as the opening grew 1 centimeter at a time. Zachariah Gonim was the first to kneel in front of the sarcophagus, shining his lamp into the coffin. Perplexed, incredulous, he pointed his light through the opening and found the sarcophagus empty. The archaeologist's world was turned topsy-turvy. The journalists, feeling cheated out of a story, left the burial site gravely disappointed. For days, Zachariah Gonim kept returning to the sarcophagus, but it remained empty. The magnificent alabaster coffin was squeaky clean. The sleeping dead? Now what? Had the mummy of Sekhemket just left without a trace, or was the pharaoh never buried at all? The latter option, although theoretically conceivable, does not conform to the facts at all. Remember this? The sarcophagus was completely sealed. It had not been touched in thousands of years. On top of the sarcophagus was a last flowery farewell, possibly from his lover, who had the privilege of accompanying her master down to the vault. As I was standing in the subterranean hall, taking pictures of the incomparable sarcophagus and the flower dust from all possible angles, some impromptu thoughts flashed through my mind. Although they might be properly put in the science fiction category, they cannot be totally dismissed. I was not willing to accept the empty sarcophagus without questioning, and to bury my sentiments in foggy ignorance. What had Diodorus Siculus reported 2,000 years earlier? That some of the original gods had been buried on Earth? I was standing inside the vault carved out of the rock ages ago, prior to Khufu. A harangue of contradictions echoed from the stone walls, as if Hermes himself was sitting there, laughing at my confusion. On the one hand, a magnificent sarcophagus unequaled in its beauty. On the other, a roughly hewn vault in the rock, without polished ceilings or monoliths. The powerful yet delicate appearance of the sarcophagus was out of place inside this primitive hole in the rock. It was a situation similar to the unfinished burial vault under the Great Pyramid. Was I standing in front of the sarcophagus of a legendary ancient king? Was it the resting place of a divine offspring? Evidently, it was not a permanent resting place, because Zachariah Gonim did not find a corpse. Maybe it was to be a mere stopover for a few decades or a handful of centuries at most, until his space-traveling companions could pick him up and resurrect him. Absurd? Our scientists are studying the possibility of putting future astronauts into a deep sleep for long journeys. The idea is not that unrealistic. Had XY, the son of the gods, consumed all his earthly time? Could it be that he was seriously ill? Had he accomplished his mission on Earth? Was it merely a matter of inducing a deep sleep with the help of the right drugs, then waiting for the mothership to return so it could locate him and take him aboard? Was that the reason the sepulcher did not need to be, indeed could not be, perfected with monoliths? Clearly the humans, in their reverent and dedicated zeal, would not have stopped polishing the monoliths until they fit perfectly. It would have taken years of labor inside the sleeping chamber, and that was out of the question. Once deep sleep set in, no one, no mason, no priest, would be allowed to enter the underground chamber. By royal decree, the vault containing the sarcophagus had to remain anonymous and be forgotten. That is why the priests, according to Diodorus, were prohibited from disseminating their knowledge about these things. The origins of the rebirth concept. Did this predominant idea of a rebirth arise when the original gods were preparing for their deep sleeps? Did later pharaohs merely copy what the priests, with their secret knowledge, had known for years and subsequently told their top bosses, the pharaohs, that dead bodies are asleep, that they will be picked up by the gods and carried off into space? Is this the real reason behind the later pharaohs' belief that they had to keep material treasures like gold and precious stones handy in their tombs so that they would be able to pay the resurrection crew? Is this the reason why the pyramid texts describe, in such flowery and optimistic terms, the deceased pharaoh's future journey to the stars? These questions, I grant you, are speculative, but they are legitimately provoked by the facts disclosed by ancient sources. After all, our present knowledge would not exist without the past. Even though no one has yet found an ancient sleeping king, or the mummy of a divine offspring, there is evidence that points to their previous existence. Humans are great imitators. They always follow, to the present day, some kind of model. Not true, you say? Then what else but imitation of a pretty model are the annual fashion trends followed by thousands? Humans have copied scepters and crowns, technical devices, as the cargo cults have shown, the ideals of beauty. It would be truly surprising if they did not also imitate the appearance of their gods. What example of irrational behavior can we find that has had international appeal, allowing us to draw worldwide parallels? The deformation of skulls. They are the most horrendous example of human vanity, and are so typical of human nature. Without electronic communication devices, jet planes, or TV satellites, our prehistoric ancestors engaged in a cult of skull deformation all over the globe. The deformations began at the temples and arched back from the forehead, like the torso of a wasp. Often, the back portion of the head is three times as large as a regular skull. We know that the Inca priests of Peru selected boys at a very young age and squeezed their small, underdeveloped heads between padded boards. Ropes were threaded through hinges, and the space between the boards gradually reduced. Some of the children must have survived the tortuous, incredibly painful procedure, or else we would not have the deformed skulls of adult males as evidence. What perversion motivated our ancestors to flatten the tender heads of their own children to such an extent? Naturally, archaeologists whom I consulted in this matter were unable to offer a sensible reason. They claimed that there must have been some useful purpose. Maybe it was easier to wear headbands with a deformed skull. However, a normal head with a normal forehead is more suited for carrying heavy loads with a headband than is an elongated skull. The archaeologists also suggested that the deformed skull corresponded to some kind of aesthetic ideal, or that it distinguished a certain social group from others. But friends, skull deformations are not a Peruvian specialty. They are found in North America, Mexico, Ecuador, Bolivia, Peru, Patagonia, Oceania, in the Eurasian tundra, in Central and West Africa, in the Atlas Mountains, in early Central Europe, and of course, in Egypt. Proof. Why? The children had to be deformed so that their skulls would resemble the skulls of the ancient gods. All around the world, humans had encountered the intelligent and majestic beings. Presumptuous copycats everywhere wanted to look like the divine beings. Shortly, the priests started the barbaric tradition of elongating their heads to resemble the gods. It was a great way to impress their fellow men and women. Look at him. He looks like, moves like a god. He must have special knowledge, and consequently special power over ordinary humans. If skull deformation was limited to only a single culture, one might be able to find local origins for its existence. That is not the case. In pictures worldwide, the elongated skull is an attribute of the gods. The gods of Egypt and their offspring, beckoning from statues and temple walls with their oversized heads, are irrefutable proof. I did not make up the ancient gods, the teachers who came from space, and I am not the father of divine offspring or god kings. The confusing data about those obscure prehistoric times are not a figment of my imagination, and neither is the claim that scientific books and precious objects are hidden inside the pyramids. I am not responsible for the fact that the pyramids and sphinxes are not labeled, and it is not my fault if a phenomenal sealed yet empty sarcophagus surfaces inside a subterranean vault. I have assembled this conglomeration of stories and facts for discussion purposes, because scholarly efforts follow a one-track course, and I would like to inject some fresh blood into those academic veins. When I view all the evidence we have collected about these long-gone days, I am reminded of a quote by Michel Icom du Montaigne, with which he culminated a speech in front of a gathering of eminent philosophers. "Messieurs, I simply picked a bunch of flowers and added nothing but the thread that binds them." 5. The Great Pyramid, the latest and greatest. "The more one knows, the more one is likely to doubt." Voltaire, 1694 to 1778. It has been quite apparent on a number of occasions that some scientists have a low regard for the intelligence of the general public, and that public opinion is often shamelessly manipulated by the media. This has been amply evidenced in the past 2 years by the coverage surrounding Khufu's Great Pyramid in Egypt. On March 22, 1993, at precisely 11:05 a.m., a sensational event took place at the pyramid. The unexpected, the unthinkable, occurred. An event so unfathomable and incomprehensible to classically trained archaeologists that it shattered and totally devastated the established framework of Egyptology. But the shockwaves were suppressed, contained, trivialized, and an even greater sensation, one of the most important events of human history, comparable to the discovery of an extraterrestrial intelligence, was swept under the rug. What happened? Rudolf Gattenbrink, a German engineer born in Menden on December 24, 1950, delivered a stroke of genius. 60 meters into a previously unknown tunnel inside the pyramid, a small robot with state-of-the-art equipment discovered a door with 2 metal braces. The robot had been trudging through the narrow shaft for 2 whole weeks, frustrated again and again by various obstacles. Repeatedly, the robot had to be ordered back to its starting point with the help of specially designed electrical wires. Minute adjustments were performed on the technological wonder before it was sent back into the age-old tunnel. Gantenbrink's caterpillar-type robot weighs 6 kilograms and measures 37 centimeters in length. The miraculous gadget is powered by 7 independent electrical motors with remote-controlled microprocessors. The front features 2 small halogen lights and a Sony miniature video camera that can be moved both horizontally and vertically. Despite its lightweight aluminum construction, the robot has a maximum tow capacity of 40 kilograms, thanks to its specially designed rubber tracks, which can grip both the floor and the ceiling. All the innovative ideas behind the development of this unique vehicle came from Rudolf Gattenbrink. He personally built the robot to exacting mechanical standards over a period of several months. He invested an immeasurable amount of time, labor, and money, more than $300,000 in the construction of his technological masterpiece. Technical support was provided by the Swiss company SCAP in Geneva, Specialty Motors, by Hilti AG in Vaduz, Liechtenstein, Drilling Technology, and by the Gore Company in Munich, Special Wiring. Gottenbrink's robot is an inspiration to all those perennial doubters who feel that their goals could never be accomplished. It can't be done? It can be done, with a combination of intelligence, technology, and determination. What motivated Rudolf Gottenbrink to venture into the Great Pyramid? Surely, everyone knew that there was nothing more to discover there. Torsten Sasse, a radio and TV journalist from Berlin, interviewed Rudolf Gottenbrink. "The whole thing started when I was staying in Egypt during the Gulf War. I suggested to Professor Stadelmann of the German Archaeological Institute in Cairo that those air shafts, they were still called air shafts at the time, should be investigated more closely because the technology to do so was now available. And they were truly the last aspects of the Great Pyramid that had not been explored yet. As a result, we installed a ventilation system in the pyramid in 1992. We examined the upper shafts with a video camera, searching for possible openings to the other shafts below. We determined in 1992 that these shafts have no openings anywhere. This left open the question of where and how the lower shafts end. This became the premise for our entire investigation. We named the new project Upuout 2, a name which requires some explanation, of course. It was Professor Stadelmann's idea to call the robot Upuout. Upuout is an ancient Egyptian god, whose name roughly translates to Opener of Paths. The whole purpose of developing Upuout 2 was to explore the two lower shafts. What are these upper and lower shafts? The Great Pyramid contains three chambers. Dr. Rainer Stadelmann claims that this is true of all Egyptian pyramids. He is considered the father of the three-chamber theory. All the tourists who clamber into the Great Pyramid are shown two of these chambers. The upper one is generously called the King's Chamber, although no mummy was found in it. The lower chamber, slightly smaller in size, is called, accordingly, the Queen's Chamber. Two tunnels extend downward diagonally from the upper chamber. They are generally referred to as air shafts. That is where Rudolf Gottenbrink installed his ventilation system. Tourists knew that from the whiff of fresh air that filtered into the King's Chamber, at least for a brief time. The ventilation system is no longer operational. It is not Rudolf Gottenbrink who is to blame, however, but rather the guards in the pyramid, who, for unknown reasons, keep forgetting to turn on the electricity. The lower chamber is slightly smaller than the King's Chamber. I have already described its measurements in another part of this book. There are two tunnels extending away from this chamber as well, one due south, the other north. Obviously, the tunnel openings face each other. They are found at the same level as the entrance tunnel into the chamber. Rudolf Gottenbrink's robot explored the southern shaft. The third chamber is the unfinished chamber under the pyramid. What do the experts tell us about the shafts in the Queen's Chamber? They can't quite agree. Some think they are tunnels for the souls. Others call them model corridors, air shafts, or air shaft openings. These last two suggestions are obviously flawed, because the air shafts were not opened up until the last century. In 1872, W. Dixon, a Briton, was knocking on all the walls in the chamber, hoping to locate secret chambers. When the knock became more hollow, Mr. Dixon grabbed his pick. He discovered the air shafts hidden behind a few inches of rock. Both shafts are square, with a side length of 20 centimeters. Two things are clear. For one thing, they are not air shafts. If they were, they would have had to connect directly with the chamber, which was not the case until about 120 years ago. Moreover, the shafts must have been part of the pyramid plans from the very beginning. It would have been impossible to chisel or scrape them out of the pyramid rock during or after construction. Go ahead and measure 20 centimeters. It's too small for a child to fit through. And another thing, the two tunnels extending from the Queen's Chamber do not ascend diagonally as they do in the King's Chamber. They first run horizontally into the pyramid before starting their climb at an angle of exactly 39 degrees, 36 minutes, and 28 seconds. Most Egyptologists agreed that the shafts dead end after a short while. That was before Rudolf Gottenbrink's robot obliterated the experts' opinions. The Opener of Paths. March 22, 1993, was as hot a day on the plain of Giza as any other, and the humidity inside the pyramid was just as high as usual. Inside the Queen's Chamber, Rudolf Gottenbrink had built himself a makeshift table out of two sawhorses and boards. The table held the command center for his remote control and a monitor which delivered crystal-clear images from the robot's camera. A video recorder gathered all the pictures on tape. An assistant gently guided the extra-thin and extra-light cable into the shaft. An Egyptologist from the Egyptian Antiquity Service was observing the monitor with increasing astonishment, while Rudolf Gottenbrink, with intense concentration, operated the controls of the robot. The whole team was under much pressure, because the Egyptian Antiquity Service was planning to cancel the project on this very day. The travel agencies were complaining because tourists were not allowed to enter the Great Pyramid. The Antiquity Service was losing revenue. Admission to the Great Pyramid, after all, is not free. Inch by inch, Gottenbrink's miniature robot climbed up the steep shaft. The headlights mounted on the front of the robot illuminated scenes which no human eyes had seen in at least 4,500 years, since Khufu, the presumed builder of the pyramid, had ruled from 2551 to 2528 BC. Laboriously, the robot toiled on, past smoothly polished walls, over small piles of sand and pieces of debris that had fallen from the ceiling. Finally, 60 meters deep in the bowels of the pyramid, came the first surprise. On the floor, the robot located a broken piece of metal. Right behind it was another sensational discovery. The robot's camera registered a barrier, a sliding door of sorts, which blocked the whole shaft. The upper part of the door showed two small metal brackets. Part of the left one was missing. Rudolf Gottenbrink steered his robot toward the door and aimed a laser beam at the door's underside. The red laser beam, 5 millimeters in diameter, disappeared under the door, proving that it was not resting firmly on the floor. A small piece of rock was missing from the right-hand lower corner of the door. The robot's camera recorded dark dust, which, presumably, had been blown through this tiny opening over the course of thousands of years. The robot's journey, however, had ended. Michael Hasse, a mathematician from Berlin, determined the exact location of the mysterious door. It is located on the south side of the pyramid, approximately 59 meters above the ground, between the 74th and 75th tier of blocks. If the shaft which is blocked by the door continues at the same angle, it would reach the outer wall of the pyramid about 68 meters above ground. Naturally, Rudolf Gottenbrink climbed the outside of the south wall searching for an exit hole without success. A sensation under wraps. Finding a 60-meter shaft inside the pyramid is quite a sensation. So is the discovery of a door blocking it. One would expect Egyptologists to appreciate Gottenbrink's effort and personal accomplishment. One would expect him to receive praise and recognition proportionate to the magnitude of his discovery. Since it is not unusual for a star or comet to be named after the astronomer who discovered it, I will refer to the new shaft as the Gottenbrink shaft, and I applaud my colleagues who do the same. Egyptologists hold a different view, however, one that is clouded by narrow-mindedness and envy. They claim that the shaft has long been known to exist by other experts. That is only a quarter truth. It is true that the existence of the horizontal tunnels extending south and north from the Queen's Chamber was known. No Egyptologist, however, had any idea that one of the tunnels was at least 60 meters long. On the contrary, the shafts were called soul tunnels, which end after a short time. Besides, assumptions do not a discovery make. One can assume all kinds of things. In reality, however, the 60-meter shaft and the door barrier were discovered by the German engineer Rudolf Gantenbrink, and that's the truth. Gantenbrink is not out to create a stir. His main purpose is the preservation of antiquities. He would also like to liven up archaeology with some fresh impulses and to make it more attractive again through the use of new technologies. He is a hard-working, sincere thinker who lends his expertise and genius to a fascinating branch of science. Evidently, Egyptologists have no use for his contribution, and Gantenbrink was muzzled. At first, Gantenbrink's discovery of the shaft was ignored. Although this sensational event took place on March 22, 1993, with the express knowledge of the experts at the German Archaeological Institute, GAI, in Cairo, and the Egyptian Antiquities Service, there was nothing but silence. The public was not informed. No one was allowed to talk about it. Most likely, the discovery would never have been acknowledged at all, or at most with a brief statement, if it hadn't been for coincidence, and for Rudolf Gantenbrink himself. Gantenbrink showed a copy of his phenomenal video, recorded by the robot, to some experts. Somehow, the British press got wind of it and ran a brief item called Portcullis Blocks Robot in Pyramid, 2 weeks after the fact. The news item was faxed to Cairo. What was the reaction? The German Archaeological Institute in Cairo denied the report. That's complete rubbish, the institute's media representative, Crystal Igorov, told the news agency Reuters. She maintained that the tunnel was nothing but an air shaft and that the miniature robot had been deployed to measure the humidity inside the pyramid. She also affirmed that there were no more chambers inside the Great Pyramid. Do you feel like someone is pulling the wool over your eyes? Well, you're right. The archaeologists at the German Archaeological Institute knew that the official statement was not true. The robot, after all, was not equipped with any kind of humidity gauge on its excursion into the Gantenbrink shaft. But it gets even better. Professor Rainer Stadelmann, the great poobah of German Egyptology and director of the German Archaeological Institute, summarily denied the possibility that a secret chamber may be concealed behind the tunnel door. In front of journalists, he declared that it is well known that the pyramid was long ago robbed of all its treasures. One of his colleagues, Dr. Gunter Dreyer, himself an Egyptologist, chimed in. There is nothing behind this door. It's all a fabrication. Before I can go into detail about how this illustrious clique of Egyptologists from Cairo discredited Rudolf Gantenbrink, I feel compelled to examine the various views concerning the interior of the pyramid. It is totally presumptuous to claim that the pyramid holds nothing besides the three well-known chambers, and that nothing could possibly be concealed behind the newly discovered door. The Egyptologists from the German Archaeological Institute would certainly be justified in arguing that no one knows whether the mysterious door is hiding anything. Instead, they proclaim with absolute certainty that nothing can be found behind this door, an attitude which is not only dogmatic and highly unscientific, but also, to use the words of the Institute, complete rubbish. Ancient knowledge. A historical note. In the 14th century, the libraries of Cairo guarded fragments of ancient Arabic and Coptic manuscripts, which the geographer and historian Taqi ad-Din Ahmed ben Ali ben Abd al-Qadir ben Mahmud al-Makrazi compiled in his Hittat. I would like to reiterate briefly some of the contents, which are discussed earlier in this book. Al-Mukraitsi wrote, "After that, the builder had 30 treasure vaults made from colored granite in the Western Pyramid. They were filled with rich treasures, with tools and steel made from precious stones, with tools made from excellent iron, like weapons, that will not rust, with glass that can be folded without breaking, with strange talismans, with the various kinds of simple and combined healing potions, and with deadly venoms. In the Eastern Pyramid, he created representations of the various constellations and the planets, as well as pictures of the things his ancestors had created. Added to that were incense sacrificed to the stars and books about the stars. One also finds there the fixed stars and that which happens in their eras from time to time. Finally, he had the bodies of the prophets brought to the colored pyramid in coffins made from black granite. Next to each prophet was a book which described his marvelous skills, his life, and his works that he had accomplished in his time." It goes without saying that Egyptologists don't put much stock in any of these ancient Arabic writings. They are convinced, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that Khufu commissioned the construction of the Great Pyramid, even if a number of convincing arguments point to a contrary finding. The attitude of these Egyptologists is reminiscent of the famous trio of monkeys. They hear nothing, see nothing, and say nothing. To some extent, I can understand their reluctance to believe in 14th century writings, but unfortunately, they don't believe in modern science either, if it happens to contradict their sacred beliefs. A number of examples from the past 25 years illustrate this point. In 1968-69, Dr. Luis Alvarez, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist, conducted a radiation experiment at the Khafre Pyramid. Archaeologists totally ignored the perplexing data gained during this experiment. In 1988, two French architects, Jean-Patrice Dormion and Gilles Goydin, discovered chambers with the help of electronic equipment. Their discovery had no impact on the official views held by Egyptologists. The experiment was partially sponsored by the government-owned electric company of France, and it was consequently dismissed as a publicity stunt for Electricité de France. 2 years later, a team of Japanese scientists from Waseda University in Tokyo conducted a large-scale experiment using the most state-of-the-art electronic equipment available. Their response from Egyptologists? Nothing but publicity for the Japanese electronics industry. The Egyptologists gathered at the German Archaeological Institute in Cairo ignore absolutely everything, and their colleagues in Europe and elsewhere are usually unaware of the goings-on at Giza. If we were to trust these Egyptologists, nothing would ever be studied. There would be no need. They already know it all. In 1992, Dr. Robert M. Schoch, a geologist at the College of Basic Studies at Boston University, gathered with other scientists to analyze geological data about the Sphinx. Their conclusion? The Sphinx is at least 5,000 years older than had previously been thought. The commonly held view is that the Sphinx was built by Pharaoh Khafre. There is no solid evidence, however, that links Khafre to the construction of the Sphinx. The name Khafre, some think, is found on a stone fragment, which, however, did not come from the Sphinx, but from a stele of Pharaoh Thutmose IV, who ruled more than 1,000 years after Khafre, from 1401 to 1391 BC. How did Dr. Schoch, a geologist, arrive at his conclusion that the Sphinx is at least 5,000 years older than Khafre? Schoch's team planted several seismographic buoys in the ground. Then they created artificial sound waves, which produced an image of the area underneath the surface, a procedure which is quite common in geological studies. The results were analyzed by a computer, which produced reams of drawings with the exact outline of the Sphinx. It is very clear that there were traces of erosions down to the depth of 2.4 meters, except on the backside. That side had been repaired long after the original construction of the Sphinx, during the reign of Pharaoh Thutmose IV, who ordered that the sand be cleared away and the Sphinx repaired. The conclusion that must be drawn from the geological data and chemical analyses is unequivocal. The erosion was caused by a prolonged period of rains, of which there weren't any during the reign of Pharaoh Khafre, and was figured to have occurred around 7000 BC. How did archaeologists respond to Shoke's data? They were outraged. At a conference in Boston, Mark Lehner, an archaeologist from the University of Chicago, called Shoke a pseudo-scientist. Lehner's main argument, if the Sphinx really were that old, it would mean that there would have had to have been a culture capable of constructing such a masterpiece at the time. But humans were simple hunters and gatherers back then. They could not possibly have built the Sphinx. End of story. Many people, when put on the defensive, start slinging mud as soon as they run out of sensible arguments. They are afraid to lose. That's what happened in the debate between Dr. Mark Lehner, the archaeologist, and Dr. Robert Shoke, the geologist. Lehner attacked the credibility of his fellow scientist. Why such an unfair attack? One of the sponsors of Shoke's geological study was a certain John Anthony West, and Mr. West had committed two cardinal sins. First, he was not a scientist. Second, he had already published some books in which he entertained the possibility of a civilization older than those known to mankind. This, of course, was a sacrilege in the eyes of a true archaeologist. Egyptologists did not care that Dr. Robert Shoke was by no means the only geologist involved in the seismographic studies at Giza. The team also consisted of Dr. Thomas L. DeBecky, two other geologists, an architect, and an oceanographer. They, too, were convinced that the lowest portions of the Sphinx clearly suggested the presence of water channels that only occur in rock with prolonged exposure to rain, to no avail. Dr. Shoke's geological analysis was categorically rejected, and its fate was sealed by none other than Dr. Zahi Havos, the current director of antiquities of Giza. Dr. Havos called the entire study and the conclusions drawn from it American hallucinations. He maintained that there was absolutely no scientific foundation for Shoke's revised dating of the Sphinx. It is plain to see that Egyptologists are not impressed by scientific data generated with scientifically proven methods if these data do not fit their view of the world. They determine the appropriate view, unaware that they are shooting themselves in the foot. The public is fed up with scientific views. Any science that accepts the findings of other scientific branches only if they confirm its own views does not deserve much public credit. Physics is another precise science. Dr. W. Wolfli of the Swiss Polytechnical Institute, ETH, in Zurich, is a highly regarded physicist. He perfected the initially controversial C14 method used for dating organic materials. In cooperation with colleagues from other universities, Dr. Wolfli analyzed 16 samples from the Great Pyramid. They included pieces of charcoal, wood, splinters, and fragments of straw and grass. The result? All the samples proved to be, on the average, about 380 years older than the dates which Egyptologists had derived from the chronology of kings. One of the samples taken from the Great Pyramid was 843 years older than it was supposed to be. In all, the physicists examined 64 organic samples from the Old Kingdom period with various dating methods, including mass spectrometry. All the samples, without exception, were determined to be several centuries older than Egyptologists claimed,